I guess what I wanted to talk about today, I wanted to at the same time make things accessible to undergraduates and also talk about a topic that's very close to what I've been thinking about for the last few years. And so that's my attempt today, but please feel free to interrupt me or ask any questions. I'd like to talk about a really beautiful circle of ideas. And especially for students, I want to emphasize that the fancy stuff people are doing today does have to do with the stuff we knew in high school and we knew in kindergarten. It's not true that everything you needed to know you learned in kindergarten, but like great math, like we're not going to talk about great math, not mine, unfortunately, you know, but it both reflects on elementary things but gives us a new point of view for it. So I hope to demonstrate that today. So the first object I'd like to talk about are called configuration spaces. So are people comfortable with the complex plane? Raise your hand if you need a definition of complex plane.
Okay, it's numbers of the form like a plus bi, where I squared is minus 1. So you can think of it as, when I say C, you can also think of it, for most of the time, it's okay, as just the plane, things in the plane, like vectors in the plane. So if you look at configuration, conf sub n standing for configuration, that's configuration of n distinct points in the plane. And you can also think of this as like just subsets z1 to zn sitting in the plane, where zi does not equal zj. So here's a single point in the space conf3. It's three points, z1, z2, and z3. They don't come with labels or names, though. They're indistinguishable from each other. Sorry, I shouldn't have, yeah, but that's the subset. So that one point is this picture is a point in the space. So just to give us a little bit of a feel, what's a loop in the space? I mean, a loop in the two-dimensional plane, of course, like the circle is a loop. This is a loop. It's just a path that begins. Here's a loop. It's a path that begins and ends at the same point, a continuous path. So just to give you a feel, here's a loop in conf6. So it's the space of configurations of n points. I'm coloring them different colors, just so if you want to keep track of which one's going where. And what's a loop of configurations? I think of a configuration as a bunch of robots. There's 6 robots here. And you say go. And then they all start like moving around the room. They can't bump into each other. That's what distinct points is. And then they come back to where they started. The green doesn't have to come back to green. I think it does in this picture. But the green can go somewhere else, okay? But that's what a loop means. You have to end up where you started. So the configuration that you end up with has to be this configuration. So here's a loop. So it can be. There it is. So the topology, what I want to understand is the topology of this space. What does it look like? It's some very high dimensional space. If you think about it, how many degrees of freedom are there? To describe where this point is, it's one complex number. Or if you want two real numbers, x and y coordinate. But there's 6 of them. So it's 6 times 2, it's 12 real dimensions. That's a pretty complicated space. But if you can understand what the space looks like, you can understand all functions on the space, for example, and how they behave. So as we're going to see, space of configurations, it can be particles in a box, it can be satellites orbiting the Earth, it can be robots in a factory floor. And you can have lots of basically problems. You don't want things to bump into each other. You want this configuration, you want to start with this and end up with that. What's the quickest path? There's a million questions about those specific systems. I don't study any of them. I always say anything I prove will apply to all possible problems, even problems that come up in 100,000 years. You're going to have to use what I came up with, you know. Because when you understand the space, you understand all possible problems. It's true. I don't end up saying, like, okay, well, now solve that robot problem. That's, like, below us. We're pure mathematicians here, right? No. So that was a loop. Let me give it one more. It's just fun to do. Now, this is 6 points. It can get incredibly complicated. So this is, okay, they're hitting each other. They're not supposed to hit each other, but it's hard to make them not hit. So there, that's another loop in a more complicated configuration space. And here are appearances. By the way, this is a true, apart from the size of the satellites, this is from Google Earth. This is the actual number of satellites that are orbiting the Earth. They're about 15,000 satellites. Of course, thankfully, they're not this big. I wouldn't be hitting each other. Then I'd really be employed. I'd be charging a lot more money here. I don't charge anything now. But anyway, and there's robots on a factory floor. They come up all over mathematics, and today I'm going to talk about a fundamental place where they come up in mathematics. So that's configurations. Let me talk about a different space, and then we'll connect them. Let's look at the space of polynomials. So what we want to understand is one of the most basic and classical things in mathematics. Let's look at a polynomial, p of x, in one variable. And I want it x to the n plus an minus 1, x to the n minus 1, etc. This is the standard, the general degree n polynomial. And I want to concentrate on the following. Monic, which just means the coefficient in front of the top term is 1. Complex polynomials, meaning each one of these coefficients is a complex number. And finally, square free, which means no multiple roots. It just means like no repeated roots. So like if 3 is a root, you don't have a factor x minus 1 squared. And no multiple roots. Most problems about polynomials can be reduced to these. But these are particularly important and I want to concentrate on. So monic, complex, and square free. And let poly sub n be the space of all such polynomials. And what do I mean by the set? Okay, yes, it's just the set. It's all such degree n polynomials. But you can think about it literally, this set, this space, has a nice structure on it. Namely, it's just n tuples of complex numbers. Because I just marked down, what are all the possible polynomials? Well, you just put in a0 is any complex number, a1 to an minus 1, right? I can put in, you give me any 3 complex numbers, 3, 2 plus I, and 1, and I can make p of x is like x to the 4th plus 3x cubed plus 2 plus I, x squared plus 1x, give me another number, 18, or minus 18. You can tell I'm not very original in my number picking, but right, if you give me 4 numbers, I make a polynomial if those are the coefficients. And conversely, so the information, the data that gives a polynomial is nothing more than n numbers, a0, a1, to an minus 1. So it's a pretty simple space. It's high dimensional, but it's a bunch of complex numbers.
You have to be ordered, though. I mean, you have to know which ones are
which. You do have to know which ones are which. Good point. You have to know which one of these comes first. So let's let that be the space of all the polynomials. These two spaces are connected to each other. There's a bijective correspondence between them. And in fact, there's a map called a homeomorphism, which just means it's a continuous bijective correspondence, and the inverse is continuous. So it's one-to-one and onto. That's what I mean by bijective. One-to-one and onto, continuous with continuous inverse. And in topology, spaces that are related by that relation of having a continuous map that's invertible and the inverse is continuous, those are considered the same. So like a coffee cup and a donut's the famous example. But what is the bijection here? Well, see, a polynomial, remember, when I say space of polynomials, I'll always mean monic, degree n, square free, no repeated roots. So if you give me n distinct numbers, a configuration of n distinct points, I can just create a polynomial with those n numbers with those n roots. Conversely, if you give me a polynomial over the complex numbers, as you know, the fundamental theorem of algebra says you have n roots. And if I'm declaring to just look at polynomials with no repeated roots, that gives me just n points. I just mark down where the roots are. So the fact is that the points being distinct is exactly the condition that you're no repeated roots. So this bijection, how this works, it's basically called marking down the roots. This direction is called marking down the roots. If you give me a polynomial, this, I can figure out the there's sort of different, in the space of polynomials, it's just the point 3, 2 plus I, 1, minus 18. But I can mark down the roots. I mean, I don't know how to solve this polynomial. So, come on, undergrads. Whatever those four complex, but you know there exist 4 roots over the complex numbers. And if I'm just looking at things that I've declared, it's distinct, if this is square free, that means you get 4 distinct complex numbers, and I just mark them down. There's no order to them, right? Roots don't come with an order. And I just like mark them down in the plane, and that's how I get a configuration.
That polynomial could have repeated roots, though.
Yeah, sorry, thank you. Yes, I just randomly wrote this. This could have repeated roots. So what's the condition? We'll get that in a sec. a way just to give you a little feel about moving around, I'm going to start out with from configurations and create polynomials. So I looked at the axes. Here's like 0, I, minus I, like 1, 2. 0, 1, 2, 3, minus 1, minus 2. So I just marked down the points minus 3, 1, 1, and 3. Right? Plus 0, I, plus 3. And then we take the polynomial with those roots. It's just x minus 3 times x minus 1 times x plus 1 times x plus, oh, sorry, if the roots are x minus 3 plus times x minus 1, etc. You get this. And I'm going to move the roots around. You can go the other way. I'm going to move the roots around. And as we're moving around, it's going to mark down, once in a while, it'll mark down what the polynomial are. It's a complicated relationship. So right there, I wish I could freeze it. Sorry. My wife made this, so I take what I get. I don't complain. Okay? So I'm moving around. It's really cool. This cool relationship between, like, I'm over here, and I'm in the space of polynomials messing with the coefficients. And there are solutions, right? There are roots, so it's changing what's in your room. And then you have the room that's keeping track of the roots, and you start moving around the four roots, and it's pushing my coefficients around. Okay. What's the condition in that? So the space of all polynomials, and this has the structure of an algebraic variety. An algebraic variety is a space, it's like a subset of n-dimensional, complex n-dimensional space. That's described by roots of polynomial equations. So we're looking at the space of all polynomials, square free. That's described by a polynomial equation. That's the cool thing. And we all know this. Look, here's a polynomial, monic polynomial. X squared plus bx plus c, right? That's the arbitrary polynomial. And all the monic polynomials, you just alter b and c, you get all monic polynomials, right? Of degree 2? Well, I ask you, what's the condition on not having repeated roots? Well, we all know the roots are like minus b plus, so plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac. A is 1. So it's that b squared minus 4c, what's under the radical in the quadratic equation, is not equal to 0. Right? That's what it means to not have repeated roots. This is an algebraic equation, a polynomial equation, in the coordinates. So it's really cool. If you want to know, let me just point something out. If you want to know whether a polynomial has repeated roots, you don't have to find the roots. You just have to take the coefficients, b squared minus 4c, and see if you're 0 or not. So this is a great theme in math, just for the students, that when you're studying an object, like, I want to understand polynomials, and this is going to infuse my entire talk. I want to understand a polynomial. How do you find roots of a polynomial? What's a good algorithm for doing it? Etc. What you do, you look at the space of all such things. If you're studying widgets, you look at the space of all such widgets, and then you describe it as a widget, or like using widgets. So it's like a polynomial that describes the space of polynomials. And then you apply your understanding of polynomials to that. That's like a ridiculously powerful mathematical method. For cubics, it gets more interesting. Here's an arbitrary monic polynomial of degree 3. Right? It's three complex numbers, and I can build a polynomial of degree 3, monic. So how do you so you can ask me, this is just like Tyler said, well, how do you know whether or not that might have repeated roots? Here's my claim. This is a pretty amazing claim. Whether or not you have repeated roots, so this is the space of things that don't have repeated roots, here's the condition. That's a quartic, and there's another incredibly complicated condition, but for a cubic, like, ready? Does this have repeated roots or not? I'm going to tell you right now. Well, I'm not. But put in b equals, oh, this is, I need to have monic. Okay, does this have repeated root? Put in b equals 2 plus I, c equals 1, d equals minus 18. Plug them into this equation and check if you're 0 or not. If it's 0, that means it has repeated roots. So the condition for a polynomial to have repeated roots is a polynomial in the coefficients. You don't have to solve it. And that's one of these great things in math where you can get information. If you don't need full information, you can do it often much quicker than like getting full information is like, what are all the roots, etc. This is called the discriminant. You can go look it up on Wikipedia. It works for degree n. And I think the discriminant for poly sum 5, or a degree 5 polynomial, it has, like, does anybody know, like, thousands of terms. So it's not, it's a complicated beast. Okay, so the object, one of the objects I'm studying, this is the space of polynomials of degree 3. It's a space of 3 tuples of complex numbers. So it's C cubed, 3-dimensional complex space, and then it's exactly, you take this, the solutions to this equation, it's some crazy looking thing, and you look at its complement, like it's not equal to 0. That's a complicated topology. And so it's been studied for a long time. Now there's a connection here with the braid group. Part of this talk, and part of the reason I'm so I've been so enamored with this topic for the last 4 years, is that it basically involves all of mathematics all mixing together in this deep and still not understood way. And I love that. And it's reflecting back on stuff from the 1500s, and there's still like tons of basic open questions. So I'm going to give you a connection with, if you've heard of the braid group. And if you haven't, it doesn't matter, you don't need to know what groups are, but a braid, we've sort of hopefully seen these pictures, and I'll show it here. A loop of configurations, which we've talked about, it's in bijective correspondence with a set of braids with n strands. So a loop of configurations of n points in the plane, which is the same as polynomials. A loop of polynomials gives you a braid. So again, remember, what's a loop of polynomial, a loop of configurations? Right, it's just 4 guys moving around on the floor. So here's a bijection. Here's 3 points, and here's like a picture of the plane. So there, that's like a loop of configurations. Like 3 of us stand up here, and we just do that. But if you trace that out over time, and you let time be this vertical direction, we're going to see as we move around, they trace out this picture of a braid. And what's really cool is, just to entice you, if you look up braid group, you can make the set of pictures like this into a group. The addition is like stacking one picture on top of another. The inverse of a crossing like that is a crossing like that. The identity is like 3 straight lines. You can make that into a group, and that occurs all over mathematics for various reasons. But it's occurring here. So just for the experts, you know, the fundamental group of conf n is the n-strand braid group. That's the official connection. And this is this thing I call Arnold's Amazing Circle. There's Vladimir Arnold, who's a Russian mathematician, who, interestingly, I think in 1974, it came out that the Fields Medal Committee was going to award him the Fields Medal. But since he was Jewish, there was actually a Soviet guy on the committee, and he vetoed it, because he didn't want a Jew, even though it was from the same country, to win the Fields Medal, even though lots of others have. But that came out. He's one of the great mathematicians in the last 100 years. And he, in particular, he solved Hilbert's 13th problem when he was 19. But that's another story. But this topic, this is a circle of ideas I'm describing here, is really due to Arnold. It goes back hundreds of years in some sense, but he's the one who tied all these topics together, the topology of conf n, I'm just using words here, algebraic geometry, absolutely, complex analysis, problems about polynomials, Galois theory, braid groups, cohomology theory, all these things are part of one beautiful circle of ideas. Of course, I can't talk about it all today, there's tons of background here, but I just wanted to give you, this is where all these topics come together. Today, I want to focus about problems, very concrete problems about polynomials. And here are the 3 things I want to talk about in the rest of the talk. The first one is unsolvability of the quintic, which you may or may not have heard about. It's like trying to do the quadratic equation, you want to solve a cubic, quartic, etc. Root finding algorithms. Suppose I give you a polynomial, this is real life thing. You have a polynomial, you don't need to know the roots exactly, I just want to find them within epsilon. How hard is that? Understand that problem. And the third is to understand polynomials over finite fields. When does a polynomial have a solution over a finite field? For example, if you take x squared plus 1 equals 0, that's a polynomial equation. And if you do it mod 3, when I say over a finite field, like f3, what I mean is like, when is there a number, is there a number mod 3 where x plus 1 is congruent to 0 mod 3? The answer is no, because 0 squared plus 1 is not congruent to 0. 1 squared plus 1 is not congruent to 0 mod 3. The only other number mod 3 is minus 1, or if you want 2, 2 squared plus 1 is 5, which is 2 mod 3 is not 0. So there's no solution mod 3, but there exist solutions mod 5. For example, x equals 2 is the solution of this equation mod 5. So for some primes, say, it has solutions. For others, it doesn't. And believe it or not, this has something to do with the space of polynomials. I mean, it doesn't. And there are many, many more things. And the theme of the rest of the talk is that the fact that this space of polynomials, monic, square free, degree n, that that's topologically complicated, what do I mean by that? I can quantify it in terms of invariant things we study in topology, but just that it has lots of holes in it, but it's complicated, ends up implying, this is the theme, that problems about polynomials are hard. Solving finding roots of polynomials and other problems, hard. And it's because of the topological structure. And I'll just say that this thing, I can replace polynomials by like algebraic function. I mean, this is the beginning of a huge, beautiful, and very deep subject. So let me just talk about the first problem, unsolvability of the quintet. So let me remind you, we learn in, I don't know when we learn it. I don't remember learning it, but P of x equals x squared plus bx plus c. That's an arbitrary degree 2 polynomial that is monic, meaning the first coefficient is 1. We know it has two roots, minus b plus this over 2, and minus b minus that over 2. It's horrible when my daughter, my 15-year-old daughter, saw me doing this. She's like, that's what you're studying? You're still studying? Like, but I'm taking the cohomology of the moduli space. She's like, you're studying the quadratic equation. And of course, to math people, it's like, wow, you're saying something about the quadratic equation? That's great, because we're used to such fancy things that you can shed light on, you know. So anyway, so maybe one day she'll respect me. there's in 1540, Tartaglia discovered, of course, it's due to Tartaglia. In fact, it's called Cardano's formula. In fact, there's a principle called Arnold's principle, like Vladimir Arnold. Arnold's principle is that if something is called Smith's theorem, it is never due to Smith. And I heard, and of course, the thing is that Arnold's principle is not due to Arnold. But it's called Arnold's principle. Anyway, it's called Cardano's formula. It was published in 1540 in his Ars Magna. And Tartaglia proved, Niccolò Tartaglia, he gave a way to figure out the roots, again, without factoring or anything, without doing all this stuff, a general formula for the roots of a degree 3 polynomial. Now, it's extremely complicated. So I just chose this very special form, this very special kind. We have a cubic factor with coefficient 1, and then just a linear factor and just a constant. By the way, incidentally, you can find the roots of an arbitrary, by clever substitutions and change of variables, an arbitrary cubic polynomial reduces to finding the solution to this. So this is actually the arbitrary one, but then there's a solution. And you might say, I don't get it. I'm supposed to have three roots, three complex numbers. There's a cube root here. And just like we have plus or minuses, when you have a square root, a square root of 2, what's the square root of 4? Right? It's plus 2 or minus 2. It's not a single valued function. We always shove that under the rug. When you take the cube root of 2, that has three actually complex number solutions. Three solutions. Cube root of 9. Oh, that's a hard one. Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, it's 3. Yeah. Right. No, anyway. I better not do this. But so hidden in here are three solutions. Although, let me just say, even for mathematicians, professors, this guy's supposed to have, like, three different solutions, but so does this guy. So, like, shouldn't this really have 6? Because you can make choices. There's all these weird issues like this that the Russians rightfully obsessed about that in the West we just always forgot about. Anyway, so we gave this great formula. And amazingly, Ferrari, before he founded a great auto company, apparently, in 1545, he was a student of Tartaglia. He found the formula for roots of cortex. That's a great advisor. I just figured out all cubic equations. You should do cortex. Great problem. But then it was a good grad student. You know, why aren't my students doing this? Found a formula for it to quartet. And I think it was Euler, like they conjectured you could find roots of, fifth degree equations is the next one, right? And then in an amazing theorem that we usually attribute to Galois, because he figured out the exact conditions, but it's really a theorem of Abel, which is really a theorem, Ruffini published this paper in 1799 that nobody could read. And I'm not sure, I think it does have the solution in there, but it's sort of unreadable. But then Abel gave the first readable account in 1829. There is no formula for the roots of a degree 5 polynomial, just in terms of square root or cube root or fourth root or whatever you want. So again, just to remind you, went too far back. See, here you have cube roots in degree 3, and you would expect you could do fourth roots, and maybe fourth roots and cube roots and square roots. Just giving a formula. If I give you a degree 5 polynomial, just tell me the roots. And this is called solvable by radicals. And when you learn Galois theory, this is one of the things you learn. There's a proof of this due to Galois, but it was done before Galois. And what I want to try to explain to you, actually, is Arnold found a topological proof of the Abel-Ruffini theorem. And this led to a lot more mathematics. When you rediscover a proof of something, I try to express to my students, and I sort of live by this. There's a great quote from Goethe's Faust. And it's, that which thy fathers have bequeathed to thee, earn it anew if thou wouldst possess it. That which thy fathers bequeathed to thee, earn it anew if thou wouldst possess it. And I take that as a great math quote, because you just want to re-understand. Arnold re-understood solving the quintic. And he gave, I believe, a truly new proof of solving the quintic. But if you do that, then that will apply to so many other things. By the way, it's also on the first page of Joy of Cooking, that quote. Although I did read it fast. Okay, so I want to give you the idea of Arnold's proof. Why is it that there's no, how do you prove? Pretty cool. How do you prove there's no closed form solution for finding the roots of a degree 5 polynomial in terms of, and it worked for 2, 3, and 4? So here's a degree n polynomial. So let me try to transmit this to you. So what does it mean to have a formula expressing the roots of p of x of this arbitrary polynomial in terms of the variables? You think of the coefficients are changing, right? That's what we do with ax squared plus bx plus c. You plug in the coefficients a, b, and c. In our case, a is 1. But you plug in a, b, and c, and it's supposed to tell you the roots, an explicit function, minus b. It's not exactly a function because there's two solutions, minus b plus the square root and minus b minus. So you can think of it as a map from the space of polynomials to the space of polynomials. Namely, over in this room I have the space of polynomials and the parameterized by the coefficients. Right? Remember I said you can move the coefficients around. That's in this room. Walden is in the other room. And definitely it is true for any polynomial. There are, of degree n, there are n roots, and he can mark them down. And as I move around in the space of polynomials, as I perturb the coefficients, the roots are moving around. And if you have some recipe, or he has some recipe of, the roots are moving around, but if he has a specific recipe to mark down the roots, like square root of b squared minus 4c, he can take my position, b comma c, plug in b squared minus 4c, take the square root, that's a complex number, and take minus the square root, or minus b plus, and mark down the root. That's a specific map. That's what a formula is expressing. And it's not just an homeomorphism, it should be a bijective correspondence. Our roots are determined by their polynomials, right? It's a one-to-one and onto map, and everything should vary continuously. And in fact, it's not any map, it's a map that has some square roots in it. It should send, let me give an example. Here's the map in degree 2. There is such a map. You look at the set of BC, so it's at b squared minus 4c not equal to 0. That's the space of polynomials that we've been talking about. This is what I said. I have my polynomial. I take my parameters. I literally yell out, go to minus b plus, comma this. It's in c cross c, so it's four real dimensions, but still, you're doing that. That's an explicit map, right? It gives me a map between spaces. And I'm a topologist, so I like to understand, like, spaces. And in fact, it gives a bijection, one-to-one and onto, as I move around in a loop here, and this is going to be important for us, you move around in a loop in the other room. And as Walden moves around, we saw it when you move around in the space of solutions, I can get the coefficients. That direction is always doable, because if you give me 2 root z1 minus z2, I form the polynomial z minus z1 times z minus z2, and I look at the coefficients, they're like z1 plus z2 and z1 times z2, it doesn't matter. And I mark them down, and so it's a bijective thing. So, good, that's step one. Just that a way to solve it gives you a map between these two worlds, these two rooms, these two ways of seeing polynomials, via coefficients and via roots. Number two, let's put that in our pocket for a second. There's a cool map from the set of loops in poly-N. Remember, poly-N is the same as configurations. The set of loops to permutations. And here's how it goes. You give me a loop, follow the roots. So, there we go. I did it in the braid picture. So what this means is that, ready? Here's a position of 3 roots. Maybe it's 1, 2, and 3. So let's mark down the points. 1, 2, and 3 roots. I don't care where you are. And we all move around each other. Here we're like braiding each other or something, right? And you see where we end up. You mark us down. 1, 2, and 3. And you go back to the initial position, but 1 ends up at 3, 2 ends up at 1, and 3 ends up at 2. So that's a permutation of 1, 2, 3. It's really cool. If you start out with distinct roots, like 1, 2, and 3, like z minus 1 times z minus 2 times z minus 3, and I have some polynomial, and I start moving the polynomial around, I change the coefficients a little, the roots are changing a little, there's 3 people in the other room, we're like magnetically linked. But you can still see where they're going, and they come back. And so a loop of polynomials, those roots are moving around. So again, this map, so there's a map. I just said what it is. I claim it's surjective. It's onto. I can get any permutation I want. And let me give you a feel for how you do that. The proof, you just write down a loop of polynomials that gives a transposition, because you can get any permutation by just a transposition, which just means a transposition on a set of n objects is just switched to. So let me show you how you do it. Here's an example. I'm going to give you a path of polynomials in poly 2. This is quadratic polynomials. Let me do something really simple. Here's a sort of one parameter family of polynomials. P sub t of x, I think of t as time. And time's going to go from like 0 to 1. Just take x squared plus c of t. So at times in c of t, I want it to be cos 2 pi t, and I want a complex number. Cos 2 pi t plus I times sine 2 pi t. So at time 0, what's my polynomial? P sub t of x is x squared. Whoops, that has repeated roots. Or no, sorry, at time 0, it's 1 plus sine of 0, 0. So it's x squared plus 1. So the roots are I and minus I. Right, it's x squared plus 1. And the two roots are I and minus I. Now I'm just saying, like, move around the constant. And let's follow the roots, and let's do it. Thanks to my wife for doing this. She's a mathematician. So here's a loop, x squared is what I'm saying, and let t vary. So here's the space of loops. It's just moving in a circle, right? Cosine, comma, sine. T equals 1. But at each point, like at this point right here, whatever, t equals a half, I get, what happens when t equals a half? You plug that in, I get a polynomial, I can mark down its roots. And here's what happens in this case. I'm basically doing cos, comma, sine. So the two roots, it's like, these end up being the roots. So let's watch. You start out, as this moves around the circle, this is the picture, by the way, as I'm going to move around my polynomial. I'm starting here. My polynomial is x squared plus 1. Right? So the coefficients are, it's x squared plus 0x plus 1. So I start out at like 1, 0, comma, 1. I don't, this looks like 1, comma, 0. Forgive me. You know? 0, 1. And then I start moving my coefficients, and I'm going to make it x squared plus whatever. X squared plus whatever complex number this is, plus c of t. Walden is in the other room. Sorry, I keep picking on you, but he's in the other room marking down the roots every single time that I move around in a circle. What happens over here? Do they move in a circle? Not exactly. Watch. They just get permuted. It's a transposition. I just came up with this thing. I'm like, God, let me write one down. I never actually did that. But I messed around, and I just tried the easiest thing, and like it worked. I permuted the two things. So that hopefully will convince you. Whoops. I'm doing it again. Hopefully will convince you that you can sort of get any permutation you want. Meaning, if you give me, if I have 20 roots, now I have a polynomial degree 20, I can pick I can very smartly pick some like loop of polynomials that it's gonna keep all the other roots fixed and like permute 1 and 2, or 3 and 4, or any two you get. Right, as one moves along the loop, the two roots switch positions. Now I wanna put those three steps together. Solving by radicals, so what would it mean? I wanna prove that you'll never, no matter how hard you try, you'll never be able to solve a degree 5 polynomial equation. You'll never be able to find a formula for the roots. Here's why. If you had such a solution, that's a bridge from this room to the other room, it gives a map from the space of polynomials. It gives a map from the loops go to loops. I can look at all the permutations induced by all of these and all the permutations induced by all of these. And now you can prove that the square root or cube root or fourth root or fifth root is such a special map that every time I do a loop here, and now I take like the fourth root, or the fourth root of this plus the third root of that or whatever, like it doesn't switch these two things. It does crazy stuff to, you know? And so that's what you do. And you need n greater than or equal to 5. It's a little delicate to say why, but it's like that the topology is complicated. So, okay, that's all I want to say. Yeah, I don't have tons of time, so I do want to move on, but I'm just trying to give you the like feel for sort of why, how sort of this complexity implies difficulty. Problem 2, root finding algorithms. Here's a problem. Let poly of n, sorry, I realize this is bad terminology. I had poly sub n. This is poly of n. Poly of n be the problem. Here's a problem, a computer science problem. Or a math. For each n and each epsilon, find an algorithm that takes as input a monic degree n polynomial, and as output, you find the roots, but only to within epsilon of accuracy. So if these are secretly the roots, I'm trying to like just find these little neighborhoods, right? Trying to show like, I don't know where you are, but you like lie in this, this, and this. I don't have to be exact. So that's going to be a lot easier than finding the roots, and that's usually good enough, if epsilon is really small. Okay. How hard is it to do that? Like, what's the difficulty? What's the computational complexity? Maybe you're really smart and you can do it incredibly quickly. And there are algorithms. So it's very hard to show, like, to show it takes at most n to the 15th steps or whatever, n cubed step. You just come up with an algorithm that takes that many steps, and done. You have an algorithm that takes that long. How do I prove like there's no algorithm? No matter what you do, you're never going to do better than blah. Well, that's really tough to do, and I'm going to give you the idea of why that's true. Smale proved the string theorem in 1987, Fields Mem List in topology. But he proved that for all epsilon sufficiently small, depending on n, the complexity of this problem of finding the roots, just even approximately, it's always greater than log base 2 of n to the 2/3. The point isn't the exact things, at least not for me. It's that you have some lower bound, that it's like reasonably hard. And I love proving theorems like this, because it's like, I don't care if there's an alien from Alpha Centauri, she's not going to do better than this, no matter how, you know, how brilliant she is, unless she uses some other kind of mathematical theory that doesn't satisfy her attitude. Okay, forgetting that. But it's putting constraints on like arbitrarily intelligent beings. So why is this true? I just want to give you some idea. How do you prove such a thing? Here's how it works. Here's an invariant of a topological of a space. Think of like a torus or a sphere. It's called the covering number. The covering number of a space is the smallest number k, so that your space, x, can be covered by k topological walls. I just mean like little open, little disks. Let's say closed or open doesn't have disks. So an example, the 2-sphere can't be covered by a single disk, right? Because it's not the disk. But it can be covered by 2 disks stuck together along the boundary, you get a 2-dimensional sphere. How about if you take a torus, just the donut with one hole? Like, Can you put two disks together to get it? Like, the answer is no, but how do you... Well, how many can you do it with? Like, how about the surface with two holes or three holes? It's not an easy question. It's been studied for 100 years, but it's a thing you can look at. And Smale's great idea, although it goes back to Arnold and goes back even earlier, is that somehow the algorithmic complexity of the problem of finding roots is greater than or equal to topological complexity. And what I mean by that is the following. If you had an algorithm, let me say the inequality the other way. Yes, if you had a contrapositive, if you had an algorithm to find roots within epsilon, and you could do it within capital N steps, what that sort of means is that, look, let's look at all the polynomials at once. And suppose I have a great algorithm to find within N steps. You can sort of imagine that that means I understand all polynomials of degree N. And I can do it, everything in N steps. You can sort of imagine that you can convert that to, like, you're covering the space of all polynomials. That's what poly sub N is. This is the space of all polynomials. You can cover that space, like, I'm all knowledgeable in my little epsilon ball. And somehow N steps of an algorithm means you can cover with N balls the whole space of polynomials, meaning you can understand all of it. So I'm not expecting you to understand exactly how this goes, but you can imagine that there could be something like that. That's all I want you to take away. So in other words, right, if you have a good algorithm, then the space can't be that complex, right? I mean, like, the two-sphere is pretty simple, the two-dimensional spheres. The cover number is two. You put two things together. This thing, look, these look more and more complex. You can show it takes more and more balls to cover them. And then he says, yeah, but the space of polynomials is topologically complicated. You get a lower bound on the covering number. Now, that's a hard thing in any topology, and just to entice you into the world of algebraic topology, it is reasonably fancy, but it uses cup product length in the cohomology of the space of polynomials. So this is some official thing where you actually attach a vector space, in this case, over the field with two elements. But you attach a vector space to every space, and this is telling you something about that vector space. It doesn't matter. But the point is that you can use quantitative results to say the space of polynomials is complicated. It just is. That space is complicated. And now that says something about all possible theorems. It's like what I was saying about, like, robots. I'm not studying robots. I'm not studying, you know, Smale wasn't studying. Okay, he was studying polynomials. But this theorem, I think, is somehow more important than the theorem that it's hard to solve polynomials, because this theorem, you can do lots of variations on it. Somehow the implications of the complexity of this space show that, like, all these different kinds of problems are difficult. Just connecting this with problem one, there it's so difficult, like, you can't get an exact solution of a degree 5 polynomial or degree 6 or degree 7. It's so difficult that there's no closed form solution. Here we're saying, can you get within epsilon? Maybe not even closed form, just an algorithm. And you're saying, well, there is an algorithm to do that, but it's got to be hard. So it's doable, but hard. So it's the same theme as the first problem. I want to end up, great, I have 5 minutes. And in the last 5 minutes, I just want to tie this in. I thought tie it in with something I've been thinking about for the last few years. This is really an application of a whole theory that I've been working on with Jordan Ellenberg and Tom Church. But let me start with polynomials over finite fields. So here's some basic questions. Look at all the polynomials, like degree 2, x squared plus, plus bx plus c. But now b and c, instead of lying, being complex numbers, they're a finite field. You're looking at everything mod q, where q is like some prime numbers, or power of a prime. How many square-free polynomials are there? How many are irreducible, meaning you can't factor them? How many roots do you expect if you took a random polynomial? And random really has a meaning here, because it's a finite set we're talking about, right? Even if I take a degree 3, you know, it's still a finite possible set of polynomials. I can put 0, 1, if I have q is 5, I can put 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4, 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4, 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4. It's a finite set. I can count, like, you can, sometimes you have roots, and sometimes you don't, like in the base field. That's like, sometimes polynomials have real roots, Sometimes they don't. X squared minus 1 has two real roots. X squared plus 1 has no real roots. It's the same thing. But how many do you expect? What's like the, you know, what's the expectation? So for, like, and this is the example I gave before. It depends on what Q is. So these are pretty simple problems that you can solve if you're taking an algebra class in the theory of fields. And that's not, my point isn't to solve these, but this is the tip of the huge iceberg, and I wanted to like bring it down to earth that like these are basic things. And what do they have to do with what I've been talking about? Well, I had said that the space of polynomials without repeated roots is an algebraic variety. There's like a picture of a sort of a schematic of an algebraic variety. And so when you have these equations, I can just remember it was like b squared minus 4c is not equal to 0, and more complicated things for degree 3. Those equations make sense over like a finite field. So I can plug in and say, how many solutions do they have? So it's sort of funny to say, how many quadratic, how many different polynomials are there of the form x squared plus bx plus c? You know, p of x equals x squared plus bx plus c. Where everything is over the field with five elements, but I want that b squared does not equal 4c. I want different groups. How many polynomials are there? And it turns out there's 20. But you wouldn't. I mean, how do you do that? That is described by a polynomial. Yeah. So. I don't want to tell, so here's what I just wanted to transmit. There's an amazing bridge, and this is probably one of the deepest connections in the history of mathematics. I love saying that because I'm like willing to stand behind it, and there's not much math I'm willing to say that for. It's arguably like the most profound thing in the history of mathematics. It's the holy mathematical trinity of Grothendieck, Bay, and Deligne. The Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost. Anyway, not to offend, but these three are the greatest mathematicians in history. They built a bridge. It was conjectured by this guy, Andre Bay, who was at University of Chicago, but he conjectured all this stuff. It's a bridge between topology on the one hand, the complex points. Remember, look at the space of all polynomials with complex coefficients? That's a nice continuous space, and it has topology, meaning it has like holes and loops, and you can do all this stuff. On this side, there's a finite set. Ready? Look at the set of pairs B and C, where B squared minus 4C equals 0, mod 5. Like, which? How many pairs of numbers have that? That's a finite set of solutions. And there's an amazing bridge between these. It's extremely deep and difficult. I'll just give you some of the buzzwords. Look up the Bay conjectures on, like, Wikipedia. There's probably a really good, I think there is a good explanation. But these are some of the buzzwords. They talk homology. It's extremely difficult, extremely sophisticated math, but it's awesome, I have to say. And I'll just end what we did. You can apply that whole bridge to the kind of things I've been learning about what these spaces look like with Jordan and Tom, Jordan Ellenberg and Tom Church. We've been understanding more on this side. And we realize you could apply their big bridge, and so we're learning things about polynomials and vice versa. So for example, you can reprove, now this is easy to prove. It's a proof of concept. But we already have things that are beyond proof of concept. But you can, like the expected number of things, you actually expect fewer than one of the roots. You usually expect that you won't have any roots that actually lie in the ground field. You can get these exact things, and it's amazing. The topology of the space, the number of holes and stuff like that, the cohomology like is governed by how many points. You can go both ways. It's just a mind-blowing connection between the theory of numbers, like number theory and topology and dynamical systems. And you can even get the prime number theorem this way, and you can see it reflected in the structure of the space. This finite set of solutions, you get the exact count by seeing it all reflected. Yeah, so it's sort of mind-blowing, and we're just using that. Anyway, been thinking about stuff like that, and so thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Farr. Well, as you can hear, Computer Science 100 is anxious for their space, but maybe some questions at pizza, and if somebody, maybe one question, is if somebody wants to get one off.
naive question, but does any of this relate to the P versus NP kind of thing? Some of those estimates and stuff?
Yeah, the question is related to this P equals NP problem in computer science. And I'll say, I'm not sure of this specific stuff, but there's definitely, in fact, there's a guy, a thing called geometric complexity theory. Ketan Mulmaley is a computer science professor at University of Chicago, incidentally. And he's converted, definitely the problem of P equals NP is now purely a mathematical problem, absolutely in the flavor of this. It's much more difficult though. I mean, big surprise. but it's a difficult, but it's about like a Lie group acting on a space. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, for my particular taste in mathematics, this was an absolutely fantastic lecture.